It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen. Welcome you to the 97th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. My most weekly pieces for the Westchester Guardian are at website www.westchesterguardian.com. They include the 170th column, the Creative Disruption Series. But I hope you'll read the column, enjoy them, and if desired, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And John Mack is JohnMack. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. You'll find links to the previous radio shows and to my online free daily newspaper at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. And in that newspaper gives you only one email per day. The list of upcoming shows is also at the site. My guest next Sunday, July 26th, is writer producer Bonnie McBird, author of, among other things, the much praised movie Tron. This, as I mentioned, is the 97th episode in the series, and in the 100th episode, on August 9th, I will have the number of the previous guests at the microphones to fill us in on their recent exploits. The note on the previous show, back in June, I had motel owner, then one-time college basketball player, Steve Lawrence, as a guest. Then he related that he, at the age of 73, will be playing in the Senior Olympics held this month in Minneapolis, in the Pope 70 age group in 3-on-3 basketball. Steve did play in 9 games in the tournament, and in the field of 25, his team brought home the bronze, finishing third. Steve plans to continue playing with the goal of competing in the post-80 category 7 years from now. Congratulations to Steve, and may he keep draining the jumper until he plays in the post-90 competitions. Now, now to this show, the 97th in the series. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I do hold the online participation of callers to near the conclusion of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is human rights activist Robin DeConte. I screw that up all the time, Robin. Don't I apologize. Who has spent most of his adult life in Guatemala. So I first met Rob at the local Barnes & Noble, where previous guests Jim Casey, Don Wersman, and I often congregate. After talking to Rob for a while, I felt he would be a great addition to the list of guests who have passed through this microphone. So let's get to the show. Good evening, Rob. Welcome to the show.
Evening, John. Thank you very much for inviting me to be on the show. It's a pleasure.
Okay. Let's start at the beginning. Where exactly did you grow up and go to early school?
Right here in Yorktown Heights, so we're practically neighbors. Went to elementary school at the Ben Franklin School. Middle school was Copper Beach, and I'm a graduate from Lakeland High School.
Okay, and what were your earliest aspirations then?
Well, actually, I've been also a lifelong member of Grace Lutheran Church in Yorktown, and been pretty much formed and molded by the education I received there, by the community I felt there. And so even as a youth, what I felt called to do was become a Lutheran pastor.
That
was my plan. Yeah.
You mentioned to me that one of the major influences in your life up until college was the pastor there, Reverend Timothy J. Kennedy. But I've had some very dynamic local clergy on the show, St. Mary's Episcopal Rector Claire Woodley and past St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Roman Catholic pastor Tom Sandy, but I never knew Reverend Kennedy. Is he still active? And would you tell us about him?
Oh, he's a remarkable man who's just coming up on the end of his pastoral career. He's about to retire, I believe, in October from the church. So he's putting in his final sermons. But a kind-hearted man, an intelligent man, and I think one of the things that I most appreciated about him, besides his friendship, is his ability to preach. He knocks him out of the ballpark every Sunday, and seeing just the way he moved hearts and shaped our thoughts with his word from the pulpit moved me. And basically sitting there in the pews looking up at him, I said, that's what I want to do with my life. That's the kind of person I want to be.
Yeah, I did meet him. They're one of the sponsors of the community food pantry that's headquartered at St. Mary's Episcopal Church. Satan and Grace Lutheran are contributors to it. Then we actually had the volunteer luncheon at Grace Lutheran this year. Then he welcomed us, and then the other people that were there. Yeah, so and I guess the hunt's on for the new pastor, I guess.
Yeah, they're just beginning the process. Actually, I don't think they've begun the call process quite yet, but I think they're forming the committee and going through the necessary steps to find someone to fill those mighty big shoes.
And then, where did you go to college, and what was your major? What were your plans then?
Well, even in this, Pastor Kennedy had a major influence. He was a graduate of a small Lutheran college in Hickory, North Carolina, called Lenore Ryan College. In fact, he had met his wife there, and would go back to visit her family because she's from the area, which is in Hickory, North Carolina. So one time on a trip back down south, they invited me to tag along and visit the college, and it was one of those love at first sight visits. I immediately felt at home on the campus. It's a Lutheran college, relatively small. I think back then it was maybe 1,200 students at most.
The volume's going down just a bit, Rob. Can you do anything about that?
Yeah, I'll move it a little closer here. I'll speak up a little also.
Okay.
So the college is a Lutheran college, liberal arts, but I decided that I wanted to not only attend, but also study theology and philosophy as my major.
And prior to graduation, when, according to your note, you planned to go off to the cemetery,
that's further down the road, hopefully.
One of those life-changing experiences that many of us have, just a coincidence. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I think life is full of those pivotal moments, the ones where you arrive at that point and you realize that things just aren't going to ever be the same again. And for me, I was planning on going to seminary. I'd already chosen Chicago, the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago, LSTC. I liked the kind of urbanness of that place and their programs. But I received a little bit of sage advice from the father of a friend of mine who's also a Lutheran pastor. And he said, listen, instead of going straight from 4 years of theology and philosophy studies into another 4 years of seminary, why don't you take a break, get out into the real world, and get your hands dirty. He said, in that way, all of that real-life experience that you get during that time will help serve your studies, your seminary studies. And I thought that was brilliant advice, but I wasn't sure exactly how to do that. Saying go out and get your hands dirty in the world is a fine thing to say, but how to make that actually happen is a little bit more difficult. And then, in this one coincidental stroke of luck moment, I was walking through the campus, and I saw a poster on a billboard, and it was for a Habitat for Humanity work camp, leaving, actually, on graduation day to Guatemala. And I thought, well, that's certainly dirty enough, and maybe after going on this work camp, I could see whether I like Habitat or maybe Peace Corps is more my style. see if maybe international work actually is something that moves and motivates me or just scares the boo hinky out of me. So I thought it was the perfect opportunity, and I signed up for the work camp.
I just finished reading Jimmy Carter's most recent autobiography, The Full Life. In it, he mentions that when he became president in 1977, Guatemala was ruled by the military junta. Was it that still the case when you arrived 11 years later?
No, actually, I arrived in the time of the first democratic president in Guatemala's recent history. There's a lot of history to get involved in and talk about, and a lot that actually involves the United States. Basically, after a
just sinking again, Rob.
Backed coup in 1954, a democratic president was overthrown, and a series of military dictatorships, like you said, all the way through the 60s and 70s, and all through the 80s, Guatemala suffered under the heel of one military dictator after another. I arrived in 1989 in Guatemala as a Habitat volunteer, and it was in the first years of the first democratically elected president after basically three decades of military dictatorship.
Did you speak Spanish when you arrived?
During the work camp? No, I mean, I did the basic, high school Spanish.
Like a little louder again.
Yeah, I could order a beer and ask where the bathroom was, but much more than that was beyond me. But when you actually sign up for Habitat, and what happened is that after the work camp, which was a month long, I just fell in love, both with Guatemala, with international work, and with Habitat for Humanity. And I said, this is the road I want to go down now. I want to be a Habitat volunteer for a while and just see what it's like to live overseas and work overseas. And I signed up and fairly miraculously got reassigned to Guatemala. Joining Habitat's a bit like joining the Army. You don't get to pick out where you want to go. You can tell them your preferences, but in the end, they place you where the most need is. In my case, I was very lucky that they was an immediate need in Guatemala, so they sent me back. I'm joining with Habitat now. This is a three-year program of becoming an international volunteer with Habitat. They do send you to language school. And so I was in language school, I think, for about a month and a half, an intensive 9 hours a day, living with a Guatemalan family, total immersion program.
President Carter also writes extensively about his own involvement in Habitat for Humanity. Most of us know that Habitat builds houses for those in need, and some of us may even know people who have volunteered. But we may not know how projects are picked and what rules and procedures are part of the process. Would you give us a rather in-depth overview of the organization and its workings?
It would be my pleasure. Habitat is one of those programs where, after spending, well over 3 years with them, I left even more impressed than when I first went in. The way it was set up in Guatemala is that there were a number of pre-existing projects that were based on need. The diagnosis was done to look at the country and where some of the greatest areas of poverty were in the country. And the first projects were located there. Afterwards, other communities, when they saw the work that was being done, would approach the Habitat office in Guatemala and ask to be involved in the program. But it was always based on need, both within the community, but also the families that were selected within each community were the neediest of the needy. Families that had just terrible living conditions. The project that I was assigned to was on the southern coast of Guatemala. No electricity, no running water, brutal heat, and most of the houses were dirt floors and thatched roof, and the thatched roof was inevitably filled with bugs and scorpions galore, actually. And so one of the one of the things that the Habitat did in not only in providing the houses, but was not only to provide a safe place to sleep and eat and live as a family, but also to better the health conditions of each family. And the way the project works in a nutshell is, once you're selected as a family, you have to put in what they call sweat equity hours in the construction not only of your own house, but of three other families' houses. And so what we had in each construction site was a large number of willing and hardworking men, women, and children who participate in the building of the homes. With all that help, the brick masons and the people doing the professionals who would be doing the building would charge us very little, because they were actually almost more directors than builders. They had so many people helping out. So that kept the costs down. Buying materials in bulk kept costs down. And the houses were very, very simple. Ceramic tile floors, cement blocks, and tin roofing. And each house ended up costing less than $5,000. In fact, that was the roof. We could never go beyond that, any housing design. And they'd be paid over 15 years. In some cases, they were monthly payments. In our case, because we were such a rural and agrarian community, we'd have one payment per year after the harvest and no interest. So when you divided, say, a $3,000 or $4,000 house over 15 years with no interest, the payments were exceedingly affordable.
Oh, yeah. Now, in the United States, and maybe it's only in the United States, Carter mentioned 20 years, but he said that the idea is to keep it below what it would cost you to rent. So I guess that may only be in the U.S.
Yeah. I think that they do the study to find out what the maximum affordable payment per month would be, taking into account there are always variables like bad harvests and sick children and all sorts of that. But there were very, very affordable payments. And even if families couldn't make the entire payment at once, we were very flexible about it. But the entire idea of the payments is that all of those funds, the money that was coming in from those families paying off their houses, would go into the fund to build homes for other people, which made it that much more attractive, because you knew that when you were making your yearly payment or monthly payment on your house, you were helping your neighbors also get out of these terrible living conditions. And that's a real motivating factor. So people were very good about making their payments, knowing that it was for the greater good.
One of the interesting technological breakthroughs is this 3D printing of large-scale houses. The Chinese have apparently been able to print to make 10 houses in a day of $5,000 each. And if they could do things like that in Africa or in some of these places, particularly places that have been bombed out by a volcano or an earthquake, that would be wonderful. Now, do you know where the Habitat has gone into 3D printing at all?
No idea. We were, I have to admit, very, very far from that back when I started working with them. So much so that we didn't even buy the cement blocks. We had our own cement block factory, and that was part of the way that people could pay off their sweat equity, is by, if they weren't participating in the actual construction of the homes, they'd go over and be making cement blocks. So the process was quite long, but the other thing that we wanted to guarantee is that the construction would be earthquake resistant. We'd actually worked with technicians in the National University to find a design for the homes that would withstand hopefully just about any earthquake that Guatemala could throw at us, because it's an extremely seismic country.
Oh, okay.
We involved a lot of rebar, but the designs were built to make houses that would withstand not only the test of time, but also any possible earthquakes to rock the nation.
In describing your Guatemala time since the initial Habitat for Humanity project up until your recent funded position, you mentioned that you volunteered for various organizations seeking to better the life of people in the area. I hope it isn't too crass to ask how you were able to live and support yourself. It was all volunteer work.
Almost all the jobs that I've had in Guatemala, thankfully, have been paid volunteer positions. So, like Habitat, back in the day, and we're talking now 26 years ago, I guess, that I was started working with them. We received a stipend of $300.
It's starting to fade again. It's starting to fade again, Rob.
Okay.
Yeah, we received a volunteer
That's
stipend.
Good. Okay.
It was about $300 a month, which was enough for living. I lived in the Habitat house in the office, so that saved on rent, certainly. And it was enough to get by on. And most of the organizations that I've worked with have all paid, basically just living wages. So, yes, being a volunteer, but having at least my basic needs met.
Okay. In your background note to me, you mentioned the list of activities in which you participated in over 20 years. The list is staggering. Let's take them one by one with my questions. you mentioned teaching workshops with labor unions, student groups, women's organizations and rural farming communities. How strong were these organizations, and does the government support them or try to repress them?
They were, especially in that time, very strong. And when you talk about the revolutionary movement in Guatemala, because when I talked about the CIA overthrow of the Guatemalan government and the military dictators that came into place afterwards.
Pick it up again.
Another thing that happened was that there was an armed revolutionary movement within Guatemala. But alongside
A little louder, Rob.
Sure. Alongside the armed revolutionary movement, there was also a revolutionary social movement, and that was a nonviolent movement, but based on the demand for human rights, an end to the internal armed conflict, justice, peace. And so a lot of these organizations were very strong, especially during the time that I was working with them, before the signing of the peace.
You keep going down. If you could hold it the way you were before, it'd be perfect.
Okay. How are we now?
That's fine. If you could just keep it like that.
Okay.
I also said that working with the National Coalition of Organizations to promote the peace process and to end the 36-year-long civil war. Could you explain the civil war to us? I don't believe it's generally understood in the United States. I know I don't understand it.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, it is a great unknown here in the States, and it should be better known because it all came from that one movement, that one moment in Guatemala's history, a pivotal moment in Guatemala's history. Without going into too much detail, because I want to be a history class, but there were a series of back-to-back presidencies in Guatemala, a very progressive-minded, very focused on land reform, taking unused land.
Now we got another hit. Go ahead.
Anyway, taking idle lands that weren't being used and then providing them to small family farmers. And so there's an entire project of land reform. Unfortunately, one of the major landholders at that time was the United Fruit Company from the United States. And the president of Guatemala said to the United Fruit Company, listen, you've got enormous stretches of land. They basically owned the entire eastern coast and a good part of the western coast of Guatemala. The train company was all United Fruit. And so they were major landholders. And he said, listen, a lot of the lands that you own aren't being used. And so we're going to buy those lands from you, and then we're going to give them to the campesinos, the poor family farmers.
The only catch is that the government, this president, said, we're going to pay you the amount that you claim the land is worth when you are filling out your tax reforms. And, of course, the United Fruit Company was lowballing the value of the land in order not to pay high taxes. But the government rightly and legally said, well, this is what you claim the land is worth. This is what we're going to pay you for the land. And they started expropriating these large parcels of land from the United Fruit Company. Well, the United Fruit Company was two of their major investors and stockholders were the Dulles brothers. One who was the Secretary of State and one who was the head of the CIA. So within a very short amount of time, this president in Guatemala was painted as being a commie, you know, a red menace on our southern border, and all this to justify the eventual overthrow of this president. Again, these two presidencies are commonly referred to in Guatemala as the springtime of democracy. And many of the big social advances that Guatemala still enjoys, like free education, free university education, free universal health care, a lot of labor rights, the doing away of child labor, all happened in this time. And the U.S. government painted this guy as a commie, and the CIA overthrew the government. The people that the U.S. backed from that point on were military dictators. And so within Guatemala, a revolutionary movement took place to overthrow these military dictators and reestablish a civilian and progressive government. Well, that conflict went on for 36 years before the signing of the final peace accords in 1996. And during that time, over 200,000 people were killed, the majority of them Mayan Indians who were massacred by state forces.
Now, during that time, did a thing that you mentioned, the universal health care and the universal education, did that continue, or was that repressed when the military came in?
It has continued in much weaker form, and now almost completely undone by recent neoliberal policies in Guatemala. But the land reform was immediately undone. And so the land that had been granted to the campesinos, the family farmers, was taken back. And the United Fruit Company was able to recover its lands.
Huh. You also mentioned part of what you've done is accompanying refugees returning to Guatemala from their forced exile to Mexico. How dangerous is this? Are these people welcomed home by the government?
They really weren't. What happened, again, during the conflict is that the government, with the tacit blessing of all the U.S. presidents except Jimmy Carter, who established a ban on military aid to Guatemala because he realized what was going on in country. But Ronald Reagan, for example, and others gave their blessing to was become known as the scorched earth policy in Guatemala. Basically, the government, in order to defeat the rebels who were up in the mountains, and Guatemala's a very mountainous area, and there's jungle and there's mountains, they were very the insurgent groups, the rebel forces were very difficult to defeat. And so what the government decided is that they'd kill the fish by draining the pond. And that is basically massacring any of the communities that could possibly even decide to provide tortillas or shelter or anything to these.
And this scorched earth policy was directed at the communities that were up in the mountains and in the jungle, which were, like I said, indigenous Mayan communities. And the idea was basically to eradicate these communities and do away with any sorts of support towards these guerrilla fighters. Very clearly, one of the greatest genocides of our time, and a genocide that's barely spoken of outside of Guatemala.
Now, were you there during this period?
I was there. The conflict ended in 1996, and I arrived in first with the Habitat War Camp in 88, and then basically living in Guatemala since 1989. So, yes, I was there for a good part of the internal armed conflict. And for
now,
the most...
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, for the most part, during all that time, these social movements that I'm talking about, the students, the labor groups, the indigenous organizations, were all seen as a threat to the status quo, a threat to these military dictatorships. And the repression has been brutal leading up to the signing of the peace accords. And like I said, over 200,000 people were killed during the conflict, most of them massacred. Also, 25,000 disappeared. Los desaparecidos, people who were taken from their homes, from the schools, from the streets, and never seen again. To this day, they're still doing estimations of mass graves, both in military bases and in different communities where the disappeared and massacred were buried in these mass graves. So, yeah, being just speaking your own voice, demanding your rights, fighting for a better country, organizing, even talking about human rights was seen as a threat by the government, and the reprisals were brutal.
Well, how did the government react to foreign human rights activists or even Habitat people during this time? Were you in any danger? Were you considered a threat to the government?
Guatemala has a love-hate affair with foreigners. And when I say Guatemala, I mean the Guatemalan government, to answer your question. It's a very slippery slope. No, we were not looked upon kindly. I'd say even Habitat at times was seen as a threat because of the work that they were doing in the communities. To make a Habitat project work, you had to organize the folks, get them together and talk about why housing is important, why working together is important. And even that was seen as subversive. Again, the church at this time also was seen as a threat of opposition, and they have in Guatemala a series of martyrs belonging to the church, nuns and priests and catechists, all who suffered during this time. So no one was considered, no one was safe, not even U.S. citizens. But there was that dual thing, and that is the Guatemalan government has also always had a love-hate affair with the U.S. government. It's such a power in Guatemala and such an economic power in Guatemala. You don't want to piss off the gringos is what it boils down to. And so going against U.S. citizens would be a very tricky thing diplomatically. And so I had a margin of security that none of my Guatemalan coworkers or the communities that we were working with had. And it was a margin that I confess that we put to good use. When things got rough, I'd be called out to communities, or I'd be go to events, marches, protests, because just having the white guy there was a measure of protection for me.
Well, with these conditions, and you're starting to fall off again, Rob, in these conditions, what eventually led to the peace accords? What?
Well, a whole series of different conditions, both nationally and internationally. I mean, 36 years, the country realized it was kind of at a stalemate. There was no way that the guerrillas would be wiped out militarily. Again, because of that interesting geography that Guatemala has. But there's also no way that the guerrillas were going to take power. And so both sides realized they were at a bit of a stalemate. But most importantly, I think
is the economic cost that this conflict had, and that is that a lot of international investment wasn't arriving in Guatemala because the conditions were so delicate, so desperate, in fact. And it was the economic class that saw their interests being touched, affected by the internal armed conflict. And I think they, at one point, suddenly realized this just doesn't make any monetary sense for us. And because the economic elite is basically what rules in Guatemala, when they realized that it would be better off working in a post-conflict peacetime situation, that would be more lucrative for them, suddenly the tide changed and they began to support the peace talks, and also internationally. You're talking the late 80s, early 90s, and the Cold War had come and gone mostly, and there just wasn't support for that kind of revolutionary movements anymore, or that kind of repression anymore.
And was the military willing to give up the power it had, or did it have to be pulled away by the United Fruits or the United States government or other people?
No, there was a lot of arm twisting, and most of the arm twisting that ever happens in Guatemala comes from the international community.
You're fading again.
The United States, the Catholic Church, even the Lutheran Church played a major role in bringing the actors to the table and saying this can't go on anymore. And that's along with massive social movements like these groups that I was talking about before, the students and the teachers' organizations, the indigenous groups, the campesino groups, labor unions were also mobilizing day after day so that the peace process would move forward and take root. And it was that moment, that coming together of the external international pressure plus the internal social movements of Guatemala, that finally forced the hand of the government, and they signed what were, at the time, very progressive peace accords.
One of the other things that you mentioned was providing training to guerrilla fighters to assist them and reintegrating into civil society after the peace accords. I would still think that the government would be very, very suspicious of these people. I can't imagine them being welcomed back with open arms. Were they? And how did it work?
Miraculously, that was one of the smoothest transitions I think I've ever seen as far as what the dire forecasts were beforehand. You know, they said, you know, these guerrilla fighters, all they know is killing and all they know is surviving in the mountains. How are they going to possibly reincorporate into civil society? So one of the groups that I was working with took that on as a challenge and started providing workshops to the guerrilla fighters. And so basically we'd have to sneak up into the mountains, go to the guerrilla camps, and talk about what a post-conflict life might look like for them. And that was the start of this long training process that eventually ended up in skills training and kind of technical training for a lot of them. But still, there were all these naysayers, especially from the right and the pro-military, who were saying, no, you'll see that, you know, once the conflict ends and these guerrilla fighters return to civil society, there will be more crime, there will be more violence, and that wasn't the case. That simply wasn't the case. There's been now recently a huge uptick in violence in Guatemala, but it has nothing to do with the end of the armed conflict and the guerrilla fighters, but more the introduction of the war on drugs and the passage of the cartels from South America to the States. But that was one prophecy that never came true. There was never a rearming. There was never an explosion of violence after the signing of the peace accords. So much so that in 1999, going on 2000, I decided actually to return to the States because within country, within Guatemala, the peace accords had been signed. The guerrillas had become a political party and had done very well. They had people who had run for office as mayors and in Congress. Their presidential candidate came in a very close third, which was remarkable, given that there were something like 25 candidates running for presidency. And political crimes had all but dropped off the map to the point where there's this kind of pause, this golden moment in Guatemala's recent history, in 99, 2000, 2001, where things were looking pretty good in Guatemala.
And what happened?
Well, unfortunately, a lot had to do with the war on drugs in Mexico, which pushed a lot of the cartels further south, and a lot of the transportation of the drugs then went from Guatemala, El Salvador, or Nicaragua, either to Mexico or directly to the States. And with this sudden influx of the cartels and drugs, and also the arrival of gangs that had come down actually from the States, based in California, we suddenly had this surge in common violence. And now Guatemala is, with Honduras, one of the most violent countries in the world as far as per capita homicides go. It's called one of the homicide capitals of the world.
How did they stop that? How do they, is it to, I know that there's this supposedly a tremendous amount of immigrants coming through Mexico from the Central American countries to escape the violence, and that's great.
Right.
problems both in Mexico and in the United States. How did they put an arm in all this? How do they stop this?
Well, what we're seeing now is that the problem is that the corruption goes up to the very highest levels of government, and now we do have, you know, democratic processes. There are elections. There will be elections in September, but many of the much of the money that comes into both the government and into these political campaigns is narco money. There's a lot of money floating around to buy off politicians, to buy off police officers, and so there's a kind of corruption which is rotted out the very core of the country. So the justice system isn't effective. Those that are in charge of maintaining the rule of law in Guatemala, the elected officials, right now we've had a corruption scandal in Guatemala that has removed even the vice president of the country from power, also the head of the national police and immigration, the head of mining and energy have all resigned. Their positions in this massive corruption scandal. And so there's drug money, there's corruption, it pays off the current political actors, but also finances the campaigns of those who are running for office, so that when they get in, they owe their donors. So right now in Guatemala, there's a movement that we haven't seen basically since before the signing of the peace accords, a social movement that has grown up in the last, I'd say since May, where once again students and labor unionists and middle-class folks, people who aren't normally involved in day-to-day politics, have said, ya basta, enough of this. And they're taking to the streets again in protest to demand radical change in the country. The resignation of the current leadership, changes to the election laws so that this bribery and corruption, narco dollars going into the campaigns will stop. But it basically has to come from the Guatemalan people themselves. But the U.S. also has a role to play there, because in the end, U.S. interests are also greatly at stake.
Is there heavy pushback from the gangs and everything to the public that are protesting?
Not so much, because what we're seeing now is that the structure is broken, the political structure in Guatemala. So they've got enough money to throw at whoever ends up going into office. And because what the people are demanding now is still far from reality, there hasn't been immediate pushback. Although they are talking about counter protests now, and those counter protests could very well be funded from illegal funds. And the counter protests are basically against those that are demanding positive change. And one of the moving forces in Guatemala, an amazing organization, body that has been created called the CICIG, the CICIG. And it's a United Nations-based body that was created in Guatemala to combat impunity. And they, working hand-in-hand with the public prosecutor's office in Guatemala, have managed to uncover much of this corruption. And it's in large part due to their efforts that these criminal networks are becoming are seeing the light of day. And so this counter protest now is now directed at the CICIG, at the public prosecutor's office, basically those that are fighting for these radical progressive changes to Guatemala that will help defeat both corruption and the impunity that goes hand in hand with the corruption.
So you mentioned violence, though. Have there been any assassinations or any actually violent moves against the protesters?
There haven't. There's been an amazing amount of control, of intelligence that's being gathered. For the first time in May, when these public protests started, we started seeing on these street corners these standalone kind of intelligence gathering units that had cameras, that had microphones, and also had Wi-Fi blockers. Because like many of the other social movements throughout the world, a lot of this is social media based. It's through Facebook and Twitter that a lot of these events are being organized. And so what we saw for the first time in May was a very strategic way to tape the faces of all the people who were participating. They had drones that were flying over the protesters that were filming, and also those machines which were blocking the internet signals, not allowing people to tweet or send photographs or update their Facebook pages about what was happening during the protest. So that's the first step that we see now, is this kind of intelligence gathering where I imagine they're trying to find out who are the leaders and the movers and the shakers in this kind of new social movement organization.
You mentioned that you were involved in publishing news and analysis about the situation in Guatemala for national and international audience. I don't know if this was during the Civil War or during the present time, but how heavily is the news scrutinized there? Is there censorship?
More than censorship, there's self-censorship. Almost all of the major media, all the mainstream media, are owned by a very few wealthy elites, and you don't get a whole lot of truth-telling within the media. Recently, again, because of the internet and because of social media, there have been a number of online newspapers and online news sites which have just broken with that wall of silence and have begun reporting and stories that even recently were taboo. Some intelligent, creative, artistic people, both writers and photographers, kind of flocking to some of these sites and telling the stories that you won't find in the mainstream media. It's not so different than what happens in the U.S., but I think in Guatemala it's even more concentrated. Very few media. And the mainstream media tied to very wealthy elites and very particular business and political interests. And so it's very hard to get
the straight dope from the mainstream media in Guatemala, which is why these other sites and Facebook and Twitter have become such a tool for truth-telling in Guatemala.
And there is no regional service like Al Jazeera that's kind of steps back from Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador and Nicaragua and writes about the situations in the area?
Well, actually, some of the major groups like Telesur and Al Jazeera also covers a lot of the stories that you won't find anywhere else in the either U.S. or Guatemalan media. The one site that I'd recommend, again, it would be for Spanish speakers, but is called Plaza Pública. That's the one of the places to go for just this news that you won't find anywhere else. But yeah, there are a few, I'd say even regional, more like international, and again, more progressive-minded sites that are covering the stories that no one else seems to be paying attention to. A group in the United States called truthout.com seems to publish a lot of stories in Guatemala that you won't read anywhere else. And a number of human rights organizations that work in Guatemala also provide really fantastic analysis and a summary of news for English speakers.
Do you know any of the sites offhand?
Yeah.
That I can...
Three that I would recommend right off the bat. Three organizations which are U.S.-based or U.S. and Canadian-based, but working in Guatemala, doing good human rights work, are GHRC, the Guatemalan Human Rights Commission, who I worked with for 4 years. So ghrc.org. ghrc-usa.org. Another group is called NISGUA, NISGUA, the Network in Solidarity with the People of Guatemala, who also do amazing work in country and some fine reporting. And the final group is called Rights Action, and they're based both in Canada and the States. And do some fantastic analysis on Guatemala and Honduras.
Now, are they both .org, the NISGUA and Rights Action?
And Rights Action, I believe they're all .org. Yep.
Okay, so when I send this out, I'll publish it. On a not directly related topic, we also mentioned the help coordinate the emergency relief efforts for victims of natural disasters such as cholera outbreaks and hurricanes. And I know that you mentioned earlier that that hurricanes are a real problem. How rampant is cholera, and are there active programs against the disease?
Well, unfortunately, we spent a lot of time talking about the political oppression that exists in Guatemala, but at the same time...
A little louder again, Bob.
Sure. Yeah, we've talked a lot about the political oppression that exists, but there's also a great deal of poverty and, of course, natural disasters that occur. And because there is so much corruption within the country, a lot of what happens is that funds that should be going towards public hospitals, funds that should be going to schools, funds that should be going to clinics in the communities aren't making it out there. And a good part of this is also due to the economic elite that we were talking about, an economic elite that doesn't see that these things are all in the best interests of Guatemala as a nation and who refuse to pay the taxes that they should be paying. And so Guatemala is a perpetually tax-poor country, and because of that, there's no fund to deal with a lot of these emergencies that occur. And so there are earthquakes and there are cholera outbreaks. Recently, also some mosquito-borne illnesses. In my time, I've had malaria, I've had dengue, and typhoid fever. And very often, they're part of larger outbreaks. But because the social net that was put into place, again, by these two presidents who in the 50s were overthrown, because they've become so weak, it becomes dependent on basically volunteers and church groups and communities and the same social movements that respond in these times of need to try to assist the victims and avoid avoid more deaths. But it becomes now incumbent on the people. Yeah.
It would seem the cholera, though, outbreaks, they could devastate commercial businesses and fruit growing and all sorts of things. And it's my understanding, I could be wrong, that can be fairly well suppressed by changes in the quality of water, the quality of life there. I mean, shouldn't that be something that all classes would want to do?
Oh, well, exactly. I mean, and the sad thing is that most of these are, or many of these are preventable. I mean, obviously not the earthquakes and not the hurricanes, but the constant flooding that happens, the cholera outbreaks. There's no reason for people to be dying of cholera, but when you have the majority of people in Guatemala living in poverty and a third of the country living in extreme poverty, they simply don't have access to medicine or even hygienic drinking water, potable drinking water. And so when we talk about the people who are the victims of many of these outbreaks, and the ones who suffer greatest the effects of these natural disasters, we're talking about the poorest of the poor again, who don't have the resources, who don't have health insurance, who go to their local clinic, if it's open once a week, and find out that there's no medicine stock there, and who simply can't afford the medicine themselves. So the people who are the greatest victims, the people who end up dying from the cholera, are almost always the poorest of the poor.
You also mentioned that you were involved in leading international delegations to monitor human rights and elections. What international delegations are there to get involved in the monitoring?
Well, most of the groups that I just mentioned, actually, the three human rights organizations, all have kind of fact-finding or observation delegations that they run. And part of it is that as U.S. citizens, as U.S.-based organizations, we also feel that it's not enough just to accompany the human rights defenders that are at risk in Guatemala, to work with the victims of human rights offenses, but also to educate the U.S. population about what's going on in Guatemala. Because as you pointed out, it's really an unknown story. And so the challenge for all three of those organizations and others is to try to kind of break through that wall of ignorance or the wall of lack of information reaching both decision makers in the states, but also the general population. And one of the best ways to really open people's eyes and to change their hearts is to bring them on these delegations. And so the Guatemalan Human Rights Commission, NISGUA, and Rights Action all lead delegations, like I said, fact-finding delegations. Sometimes the focus is on justice. Sometimes the focus is on indigenous rights, on the elections, on mining and extractive industries. But whatever you're interested in, there's a good chance that there's a delegation to Guatemala sponsored by one of those three groups, and they are amazing experiences.
Have they also produced documentaries? Have they also is there much video work on this? Is there much that's available on YouTube or in the United States?
There are. My involvement was back in the day, and it was me with this beat up old camera and made a couple of documentaries on the fly, working with Guatemalan counterparts. We'd share our footage and produce a kind of these homemade documentaries to try to get the word out again. So some of mine, I think, are available on YouTube, but nowadays, recently, there have been a number of very, very professional, well-done documentaries about what's going on in Guatemala, both about justice or the lack of justice in Guatemala, but also communities that are defending their environment against major mining interests. And there have been some fantastic documentaries made both by U.S. filmmakers, Canadian filmmakers, and European filmmakers. And I think if you do a Google search, you should be able to come up with a number of them.
Years ago.
Fantastically done.
Just a little off the subject, but years ago, if you remember, there was the movie that was done with Jack Lemmon going down to find his, to what happened to his son who was killed. Was that in Guatemala or was it in Honduras?
I don't remember. I think we actually had this conversation. We were trying to remember whether it was Honduras or Guatemala. I think it might have been Honduras, just okay. Because usually all things Guatemala, I tend to come across them sooner or later. And I do remember that film. But recently there have been a number of ones. The one that I'd recommend just off the cuff is a film called Granito, Granito. And it looks at what happened during the internal armed conflict and the peace process, and then the most recent attempts to bring those responsible for these massacres and these crimes against humanity to trial. A fascinating documentary. Very, very well done.
That led me to my next question, because you mentioned that you did some documenting of the bringing the graves of the massacred victims from the conflict. Number one, was it admitted by the government that massacring did go on, and is there any accountability for it?
Yeah, for a number of years, I worked with the Forensic Anthropology Foundation of Guatemala, the FAFG, who are still doing amazing work and actually started their exhumations even before the peace accords were signed, going out to the communities and doing these mass graves where 5, 10, 300, even 500 or more bodies have been exhumed. Many of them showing signs of torture, hands bound, eyes and mouths with gags on them, blindfolds. But because this process is an eminently scientific process, that all the people in the forensic anthropologists go through these special trainings, and they're recognized by the state, perhaps reluctantly, but recognized by the states as scientific experts. And so there's been this huge database that's been created of evidence of these hundreds, thousands of people that have been exhumed and identified and who have clearly shown that they were tortured and executed before being thrown into these mass graves. And this is the exact evidence now that is being used in these trials to condemn some of the intellectual authors and the material authors of these massacres.
And how do they establish who were the people that were on duty that were shooting these people? How do they know who the individuals were?
Well, in part, ironically enough, that some of the most damning evidence has come from official sources themselves, because both the Army and the National Police were eminently bureaucratic institutions. There are a number of records which show who was working when and who was on duty where and who was patrolling in which zone. And all of that has been used to establish who the actual authors of these massacres were. And then they lead up the chain of command to the dictators themselves, the generals who were in power at the time. One of them, for example, General Efraín Ríos Montt, who has faced a trial. In fact, he was condemned for his role in committing genocide and crimes against humanity. Unfortunately, shortly thereafter, and again because of this insidious impunity that exists within the judicial system, that ruling was immediately overturned in a bogus ruling by the nation's highest court. And so they're actually repeating that trial.
When they identified the individuals, soldiers and guards, how much of Nazi concentration apologies go on? I was just following orders, and the people take that as an excuse.
Well, actually, to date, there hasn't been that kind of the Nuremberg defense. You know, I was just following orders. In some cases, that has come up, but it hasn't been accepted as a valid defense. So it's not an excuse. And unfortunately, though, most of those that are behind bars now, most of those that have been condemned for their role in these cases of genocide, in these massacres, are the low-level soldiers. They're the least powerful, ones who were kind of thrown out there and allowed to be condemned. But the intellectual authors.
I could actually see some of these people feeling that if they refuse to follow orders, that they'd be shot along with the guys who are going into the pit, you know? I don't know. Then after all this diverse activity for over 20 years, you were hired in March of 2011 as director of the first local Guatemala Human Rights Commission office. Tell us about that position and what it entailed.
Well, everything is kind of a process, right? We talk about those pivotal moments where your life changes, but there are also these moments where everything kind of comes together, you know, where everything that you've done in your past, and again, I was working in the exhumation of these mass graves, accompanying the refugees, doing these training courses for guerrillas in the mountains to help them reincorporate into civilian life. All of this stuff was coming together for me. And I realized that what I was really interested in, what really moved me and motivated me after these two decades in Guatemala was doing human rights work. And thankfully, in 2011, the Guatemala Human Rights Commission, which was a U.S.-based, Washington, D.C.-based organization, decided to open up their first country in-country office. And they hired me to be the director of that office. And it was an amazing experience. I think it ended up being much more than any of us bargained for, because the opening of the office coincided almost perfectly with the arrival in power of the current president of Guatemala, who is a former military official, a former general, who is accused of crimes against humanity when he was leading one of the military bases in the countryside during the conflict, and who, under whose administration, human rights abuses have shot up through the roof. And so in the last 4 years, basically, the last 3.5 years of his administration, the number and the gravity of these human rights abuses has just exploded. And so being a new human rights organization in country, basically, you know, opening our doors to anyone who had threats, attacks, who had been criminalized, people started flooding into our office, and it became, it became more than just a job. It became basically a way of living for those 4 years. The need was so great and remains so great to this day. Like I said, there'll be elections in September. One can hope that things will get better, but the last 4 years in Guatemala have been brutal as far as the number of human rights abuses and the, again, threats, attacks, and the criminalization of people who are standing up for their rights.
After 3.5, 4 years, your involvement with that organization came to an end. What brought that about?
Well, to be honest, we had a slight disagreement with certain policies in from the Washington office. We wanted to be a little more hands-on, I think, and the D.C. office wanted to be a little more policy-based. So basically working within the states to pressure for change. But the reality in-country was of immediate and desperate need of human rights defenders, the men and women who fight for their communities, who fight for their human rights, who fight to tell the truth about what's going on in the country. And so it got to the point where I wanted to become more hands-on and work directly in support of the men and women who basically give their all for the construction, not only of a better Guatemala, but of a better world.
All we generally hear about Guatemala in the U.S. is the heavy and rather scary gang culture and the outpouring of immigrants from Mexico to the United States. There must be some positive that you've just mentioned about that there are social movements. How accurate is the image that we have of Guatemala here in the U.S., do you think?
Oh, it's terrible, which is why I enjoy the delegation so much, because it really is an eye-opening situation. One of the reasons why I've been so willing to leave behind my country, my family, my friends, my language, my culture, is that the men and women that I've had the privilege of working with in Guatemala are some of my personal heroes. They're people who inspire me on a day-to-day basis, who are incredibly intelligent, just bright, brilliant people who see how things are and imagine how things can be and then do all they can to bridge that gap. And that kind of selflessness, that kind of inspirational, complete giving over of themselves to the struggle for a more just Guatemala and a better world is something that's almost addicting in a way. It's very hard to leave. And one of the hardest things about being in the States right now is being away from that. Guatemala is full of creative, beautiful people who are struggling under a context which is a context of, like I said, poverty, of injustice, of impunity, and yet are hardworking and resilient and selfless. Many of the folks that come up to the States are just trying to build a better future for their families, provide for their children, just like any parent would want to do. And that's why Trump can stuff it in his hat for all I'm concerned. There's so much more to Guatemala than the immigration crisis. There's so much more to Guatemala than the gang problems, which are real. And there's so much more to Guatemala even than the pretty touristy places like the Mayan ruins in Tikal and the beautiful colonial city of Antigua. Guatemala is that, but so much more. And it's won over my heart and convinced me that to the day I die, I want to make sure that I'm on the right side of the Guatemala question and doing everything I can to support those that are fighting for a better tomorrow.
Just to then decide about Trump, though, he may have killed himself with the John McCain comments. And there was a very funny column by Andy Borowitz, who is very funny, in the current New Yorker, that he said that Trump has revealed that he hadn't talked about his heroic activities, that he evaded capture in Vietnam by staying in the United States.
Brilliant. Well, yeah, you give a man like Trump a loaded gun, and sooner or later he's going to shoot himself in the foot. I'm surprised it happened this quickly with John McCain, but it was, from all intents and purposes, I think an inevitable thing. So,
you partially answered the question, but you've had so many diverse experiences in more than 25 years in a really unstable and dangerous area. I'm surprised you haven't burned out. I know that you're still looking for opportunities to continue your work there. How are you able to keep going? And just answer that about your and what's going on with the hunt for an opportunity.
When I decided to move on from GHRC, my intention has been fully to go back and continue my work there. And I had a fantastic opportunity that came up almost immediately afterwards, but we're just waiting on hopefully funding for that position. Another human rights organization that wants to expand its work and have deeper relations be in greater service to human rights defenders. And so hopefully that job will happen sometime in the near future. in the meantime, I came back to the States to kind of regroup, and I had no idea, I think, in the beginning how much I needed this time, although it wasn't really a planned sabbatical. Being with family and friends and being able to hike around T-Town and up Turkey Mountain has been a very healing experience, and I think was providing me with kind of a stress release for stress that I don't think I even realized I had. People actually tell me now how much healthier I look just after being here for these 2 months. So hopefully I'm recharging batteries, grounding myself a little more, healing some of the inevitable wounds from the past, because you can't be in this human rights work in Guatemala without it getting to you, the injustice of it all. And so this time at home has been definitely a healing time. And hopefully after visiting a couple more monasteries up here, the Buddhist monastery in Putnam is amazing. Been up to Mary Knoll and hit the bookstore there to restock. And so this has all been a time of gathering up the forces and hopefully returning soon to Guatemala once this position opens up, and continuing to hopefully be a positive force for the men and women of Guatemala.
My wife and son years ago saw the Dalai Lama up at that the monastery up on Route 303. That was very interesting. You did touch on one thing that it's too bad that you can't clone yourself, because there should be some people here in the United States bringing these things up with energy to attention, to the networks, to the newspapers, to other people that might care about this if they knew about it. And I don't think that we have the understanding here about that.
Yeah, and that's one of the great struggles. I mean, Guatemala Human Rights Commission is based in Washington. NISGWA is based in California. But there's this breaking through of trying to get people to be not only aware of these issues, but interested in them. And not only interested in them, but to take action on these issues. A lot of the companies that continue to cause great harm in the communities in Guatemala are U.S. mining companies, for example. And yet no one here knows about that. And I think it's one of our great failures as human rights organizations, but probably just due to the great amount of work that goes on, is finding a way to get the word out so that people can become aware of what's really going on there and who the responsible actors are. But even more than that, what most good-hearted people want to know is, what can I do? And so explaining what's going on and how people can take positive action to address these issues is a real challenge, I think, for any human rights organization. But it's an uphill battle, and I think it's definitely an uphill battle in the States, because there's enough here to be distracted by. You know, the electoral process here is confusing and complex and sometimes entertaining enough to make everything else disappear. And yet there's a world of good that can be done by U.S. citizens in countries like Guatemala if they were only aware of the different roles that they can play, the different ways that they can pressure both Guatemalan actors, you know, support the good people who are doing good work in Guatemala, put pressure on Guatemalan politicians, but also from the U.S. end. Writing letters, making calls to senators, to representatives, when legislation that affects Guatemala comes up.
The area that in which I live, in which you're back into now, is slightly different than it was when you grew up in the New York time. What do you find the differences to be, to jump out at you now that you're back?
I think the one thing that strikes me the most, and I wouldn't even say it as a before or after, because when I left for college, I was but a young punk, and I don't think all that terribly socially conscious of of my environment here. But when I returned from Guatemala, one of the things that most strikes me, I think, is just the kind of the lack of community here. I mean, talking to you in the Barnes & Noble is a rare kind of a treat because that kind of sharing just doesn't normally or organically happen in this area, I think. And so you've got a lot of people who are all in the same bookstore, the same cafe, and yet I don't see as much community as I see, I think, even in Guatemala.
I think
definitely not as much as in the communities in Guatemala, you know, in the rural communities where people's basically their lives depend on one another. And so there's a really tight-knit communities. But even in Guatemala City, I think there's more openness and more conversation that happens organically in public spaces than even here. And that's frustrating for me to see.
I think that if you checked out the community food pantry at St. Mary's on Saturday mornings, that you'd see what you're talking about. There's people from all different groups and backgrounds, and as young people doing community service, working to provide food to these people. And I also, St. Mary's also reaches out to Mohegan Park. That's mainly
okay.
For emotionally or intellectually challenged people. And there's a tremendous spirit that we've found there, you know. So
that's fantastic. And you know what? I'll do that. I'll come out one Saturday because that kind of stuff is what for me what makes life worthwhile. And when you're a member of that community, you realize just how precious that is. That kind of sharing and, like you said, different backgrounds, different ages. I think we just need more of that.
I'll hold you to that.
Perfect.
We've touched a lot of bases. What else would you like our audience to know about you?
You know, I think the only thing I'd say is that, you know, after spending a couple of decades living overseas and having these experiences, folks tend to say to me, I tend to hear a lot the phrase, "Oh, I could never do what you do," and I think I'd just like to say, well, that's wrong. Anyone could do what I do. I'm sure that most people could even do better than what I've done, but it's just a matter of kind of putting yourself out there, following your heart, and opening yourself to these kind of activities, which could be in Guatemala or could be in St. Mary's on a Saturday. The payoff is so much greater. This is a cliche, and it's the cliche of all cliches, and I know it is, but the payoff for doing this kind of work, the payoff for putting yourself in service of others, is so much greater than the effort itself. I know you must feel that in St. Mary's and also in the work that you do with even the podcast of making people aware of these different issues and needs. But serving others, for me, is the end all. And it doesn't take any great shakes. It doesn't take any great disciple or master or servant. It doesn't take anyone special at all. It's just a matter of getting up in the morning and doing something. And the payoff is so worth it. So,
You mentioned that you're post-Guatemala life, if you have one, or your fallback at some point, might be returning to the idea of the ministry. Are you still considering that?
It would be a long shot, I think, at this point. I'll be perfectly honest. Just because I think there are different ways of doing ministry, different ways of serving. I think at one point I had in my mind that the only way to do ministry is by being a minister, by being a pastor. And it took me a while to realize that, no, that's not the case. And it kind of gets back to what I just said. Anyone can do this kind of ministry. Anyone can do this kind of service. And I think, to a certain extent, being outside of an organization also frees you up It leaves you without a safety net at times, but it also gives you a little more leeway in order to decide how you want to spend your time, how you want to invest your efforts, the kind of impact you want to make. And so it could happen. If I ever get booted out of Guatemala, then maybe it's time to go to seminary. Certainly the subject matter still enthralls me and entices me. But as far as the day-to-day, there's nothing for me like waking up in Guatemala and being around my personal heroes day in and day out.
That's terrific. Thank you very much, Rob. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, John. It's been an absolute pleasure.
A bit of commercial information. My column appears weekly in Western The Guardian, along with regular columns by Congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission Lee Hamilton, critic John Simon, and historian Daniel Pipes. Western The Guardian is available in print format and online at www.westertheguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at johnmack13.johnmackrants. That's johnmackrents.com. Send any comments or questions to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And now, in the words the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in a book. Go to my website, www.johnmack13.com, for URLs of all previous shows. And tune in next week for my conversation with writer-producer Bonnie McBurk. As they used to say then in the old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa, Silver, whoa. Silver.